Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond.
What's up with it, y'all? Man, don't change that sound. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that down. Wiggly.
Yeah, yeah, this is Cassidy, the hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dollars, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw, and you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
What it ain't, what it do. Chili Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday nights. West West, y'all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Y'all know what it is. Episode 422 on the way. I'm your host, King Eric the Great. And you're not tuned in at the most live is direct show hitting y'all upside the head on Friday nights. Off the Cuff Radio, sponsored by Da Vinci Clothing, Buddy Boy Entertainment, Fleetwood and the Cod Pickers, Jesse's Boutique and Core Financial. I got my host T-Max with the facts on the line with me tonight.
What to do, y'all. This is Friday Night Fantasticness. OTC up in the building. We are live and direct. And tonight's show is a very special one. We are children of the hip-hop culture. King and myself, along with our co-hosts in spirit, Elon Sandman and Lady Chinchilla. What makes our guest tonight so special is this. This is one of the icons, the living legends, the pioneers, the influencers, one of the godfathers of not only gangster rap music, but hip-hop in general. This man is one-fourth of one of the greatest hip-hop groups ever to bless the culture with NWA. He is just as much of instrumental helping to influence so many artists, not only from the West Coast, but the East Coast, down South as well. This man is a musician. This man is a DJ. And most recently, a published author. Words cannot describe how excited we are to have him on tonight. And, of course, he's also, for our show, which is another first, he's our first guest that's been inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, y'all.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, the legendary DJ Yella of NWA, welcome, welcome.
What's up? What's up?
What's good, man?
What's going on with you? What's going on with you, man?
Oh, not too much. Oh, not too much. Just staying healthy. That's about it.
Dude, this is an honor, man. We're so happy to have you on, man. I mean, you know,
it's an honor
we don't have
to be on.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, folks, so first off, man, I mean, how you doing? What's been going on with you? You know, I mean, just what's been happening?
Oh, I just, you know, staying out of trouble, you know, trying to stay healthy, doing my thing. But, you know, I'm still here. I'm still breathing. So it's a good day.
Yes, it is. And one thing about it is to be such a distinguished curator of the culture, to be such a legendary participant in it, man. Like I said, your influence of what you, Cube, Dre and Easy, Arabian Prince, Egyptian Lover, all of you in that collective, what you all did, you know, is something that to this day still resonates in terms of it. I guess we're going to get right to it, man. I mean, born and raised in Los Angeles, I mean, what was it like in those early days in terms of, like, really, you know, just growing up and, you know, ultimately, you know, how you found your way, you know, into being, like, a Hall of Fame, you know, legend?
I mean, I had a normal childhood, you know, nothing, it wasn't nothing in them days. It wasn't, the gangs wasn't taking over or none of that. It wasn't even gangs at all. I mean, I had a normal childhood. We was poor, you know, P-O, but, you know, I had fun, and I never dreamed of even becoming a DJ, ever. Never mm-hmm. even really thought about it. It just happened, and I just started DJing in the club at Eat After Dark in L.A., Avalon and El Segundo, and 2 years later, Dre came along, and we just clicked from there.
Now, a lot of people don't really understand how deep you were in music, and especially everything, mm-hmm. because you were a drum major in high school, you
yeah.
know. And, of course, you know, you were among, you know, 9 children growing up. Tell us about the hip-hop scene in Los Angeles as it began to develop, of course, with K-Day. I mean, of course, with DJ guys like DJ Unknown, who you would link up with.
Mm-hmm.
What was the scene like during that time in the early days?
I mean, it was more like, it wasn't really a scene. It was just beginning, because New York had already been there, and the East Coast started it, you know. So we
right.
just listened and vibing off of whatever comes from the East Coast. But, wow, I had to just think about it. Wow, me and Unknown, you know, we kind of, I wouldn't say we started things, but we just started trying to do things, mixes for big labels like Capitol and stuff. We was trying to do all kind of stuff, mixtapes. I mean, these was real mixtapes where you actually mix songs on the tapes, not these New Day mixtapes, but these, you know, we were trying to stay ahead of the game back then. And the scene was, mm-hmm. it was kind of small. It wasn't super big. K-Day just started. And, you know, they started playing hip-hop. And, you know, it was just like the beginning. It was fun in the beginning. Everything started from then. It wasn't like it just happened. Like nowadays, it's already been there. It's established. Back then, we had to earn every stripe we got for all that.
Right.
Yeah,
you know,
even going back to your days at the World Class Wrecking Crew, I mean, y'all brought the shiny suits and all that. I'm like, y'all were the shiny suits originator before Bad Boy. So, you know, I wanted to put that out there first and foremost.
I mean, we did the suits. We were trying to impress the women. That's what we was going for. Look, because we were making our biggest hits from the Wrecking Crew were slow songs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a slow song called Lovers in the beginning, and then our last song we made was Turn Off the Lights. That became a, you know, pretty big hit back then. But we was trying to look, you know, sexy for the women. We wasn't trying to look macho. We were trying to look sexy for the women, like Prince was doing back then. So,
right.
You know, that was just the look
right,
back
right.
then.
You know,
right,
but go ahead, King.
Right. You know, and building off that, and that's where also when you got the hip hop sound, that's where you start getting the early elements of transitioning it from that disco sound to hip hop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, that was once we did all the Wrecking Crew, did 2 albums, a few singles and stuff. And then, you know, we wasn't making no money then. So, you know, Dre, you know, hooked up with E.
and Cube to write the Boys in the Hood. And one day, Dre, after it was done, Dre came and said, hey, man, we're going to make you a super group. You should come join us. You know, come be with us. So I quit my little day job that I had for 3 months. And I'm like, okay, I'm down with it. And that was the start of the, I would say, is it West Coast sound, maybe? Because there was Ice-T also. So that was the start of some gangster stuff, rather.
Yeah, and it's wild, Yella, because, you know, for what you and Ice-T, for what y'all did, you know, of course, Ice-T with his Ron Hayes album that was released in 86, that was also the same year that N.W.A. and Apostle, you know, y'all will release y'all albums. So these are two albums released in the year, 1 year, that were really, you know, from the L.A. element, because, of course, you know, big up to Uncle Short up in the Bay in Oakland, because Short was, you know, doing it a couple years earlier. So
it
I mean,
was probably
this is
like
basically
around the same time too, if he didn't do that earlier from up there.
Right. Yeah, because a year
it was
later,
funny. I mean, it just we
pop.
Grew at the same time. It's funny. We grew. L.A., Compton, that all grew, and then up north, Oakland, like all almost at the same time.
Hey, you know,
Hey, Max, hold on. I'm going to ask him this. Now, going back to the origins, like, what was your inspiration to get into music, and what type of music do you listen to, like, genre or artist specifically?
Back then, I listened to, you know, Parliament, Bootsie, Rick James, Prince, you know, all the funk. It was all the funk. Even some, there was, like, David Bowie. That was funk. One song was funk. You know, we listened to all the funky stuff. But back then, radio was like everything plays on one station. It wasn't a hip-hop station until K-Day came and stuff like that. So, I mean, we just, that's funny. I knew how to play. I was the only, I guess, real musician in the group because I played the drums. But it was just, man, we just did our thing. It didn't plan on it, didn't think about, oh, Hall of Fame coming up, a movie coming up, gold records, platinum, triple platinum. We weren't thinking none of that stuff. All we thought about was just, at that moment, was the love for music. And we just did it our way. Even the lyrics, the tracks, everything. We just did it our way.
And when you all came in the game, Yella, for what y'all brought, because when we look at hip-hop, we've had so many guests on the show. We've talked about the origins in terms of how far hip-hop really goes back. You know, of course, even with James Brown, you know, in terms of in the JBs with, you know, with you know, James really doing a lot of his ad-libs, you know, the JBs that would really come up with the funk rhythms. You know, this is going back almost 30 years before, you know, you all really come in. So, and then, of course, the 70s with the Last Poets, Gil Scott-Heron. You know, 78 with Sugar Hill Gang, this is when we really start to, you know, this is for some
started
rap
really
historians.
Started really seeing hip-hop.
Yeah.
Or rap.
Exactly.
Or whatever they
sir.
Call it, yeah.
And then,
oh, yeah.
And then the 80s, we see, of course, 1984, 85, we see Def Jam coming in, you know, Rick Rubin and Russell Simmons, you know, Run DMC, LL Cool J, Beastie Boys. So the East Coast is building. You all are coming on the West Coast with a whole different sound, and because, you know, you all, you know, of course, with Ice-T, you know, was really bringing it from his style with the Ron Hayes album to more of the street element, where you all followed up with that later on. You all gave a sound to a whole new dimension of a conceptualized rhyme and music style that, quite honestly, just redefined
rock
the genre
energy.
As we knew it.
Rock,
yeah,
had rock and roll energy. You know what I mean? Because
even
though what they were doing on the East at the time,
it was more so
like rappity rap at that time. But what you guys did, y'all went ahead, y'all took different elements. Because, you know, DMC, he had the yelling. Now, you know how he would yell on the mic, and y'all brought Doc up there, and Cube used to do that. Then y'all had the funk. Y'all had all these different ingredients, and y'all put it in y'all sound. That's what made y'all a standout.
Yeah. I mean, we try to just try to be different, not mm-hmm. biting off of everybody, you know. But think about back then. When you hear mm-hmm. a song, even if you don't know the name, you know what group it is or what camp it came from. Nobody copied off of each other back then. You know, nowadays there's so many groups and so many this. But back then, you know, we just came with our just sound. What our lyrics, we open our front door, that's our lyrics, whatever we see in the ghetto. And the thing about it, people can relate to it because there's ghettos in every state, every city. There's ghettos everywhere or all around the world. People can relate, you know, what's going on, the police, poverty, you know, whatever it is going on in the ghetto. They can relate. That was our lyrics. And our sound was just really coming from the ghetto, too. That's all we knew. That's what we knew. We did the electronic and the Wrecking Crew. Then we grew out of that and changed the whole mm-hmm. different sound. We made, you know, just made our own sound, and it just took off.
Yeah, and what was it like, you know, in terms of, you know, when you all were starting out from the World Wrecking Crew to, you know, later on NWA, in terms of, like, tell us about some of the clubs back in the day, like the Palladium, Skateland, and all those spots, you know, during that time. What was it like with the club scene?
I mean, we kind of had an advantage because we was in the Wrecking Crew, but we had a club every Friday and Saturday night all year mm-hmm. round. So we you know, we had parties every weekend. Sunday sometime if it's a holiday on Monday. So we had a little advantages. I mean, the club scene was just, because it was a teenage club, so it was just off the hook. I mean, you know, we have a 99-cent jam on Fridays, and the line is around the building for an hour before it opens up. It just, the energy was just there. Then once the club closed, we started doing Skateland. And it was like the same thing. Just a different, it was around the corner, basically. But the club scene was just so, I mean, it was really dancing. Everybody danced. When you play slow songs, everybody danced off the slow song. You know, it was just a different thing back then. And DJ, and us DJing, we learned to talk on the microphone. We didn't just mm-hmm. be quiet and do some mixes. No, you had to talk to the people. You had to rock the house back then.
Holy man. That's a very overlooked origin of that, man. Like,
yeah.
You got to be able to communicate with people to make those records transition.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The DJ was like a star back then. The DJ in a club or, oh, man, a star. The DJs were the star. We felt more like stars in them days than in NWA days. It was just different. The vibe was different.
Now, during that time, of course, you know, obviously you all, you know, are just starting out like anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about some of your interactions with some of the other artists, you know, in terms of like, you know, like MC8 of Compton's Most Wanted, King T, of course. You know, Battle Cat.
There's a guy named Mixmaster Spade was before all that.
Right. Can't forget Mixmaster Spade, the legend. Yeah, man.
Yeah.
I mean,
what was
it like?
Spade was a homeboy.
Yeah. mm-hmm.
I like Spade. Yeah. We used to do shows and see Spade and stuff. But it was just, you know, they say we put Compton on the map, but, you know, first people used to think Compton was a bad word in their mouth. You say Compton, they go, ugh, Compton. But then somehow we just changed that all around. And then all the Quicks and the King T's, everybody just came after us. It just flowed right in. Then next was Long Beach, you know, all of that. So it was just, it's crazy. It was just a sound that's still around today. Hip-hop is still around. Hip-hop is in all music. I don't care if it's country, western, all kind of music.
Oh, yeah.
That hip-hop beat is somewhere in there. And it just, and it wasn't supposed to last this long. It was supposed to be like disco, in and out. But it didn't. It just kept going and kept going. Now when it went down south, now it went up to Ohio with Bone and them. I mean, it's just all over now. Hip-hop
and
is
gone worldwide.
Say it ain't going nowhere.
Yeah.
Going into that first project when you guys,
mm-hmm.
And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you on to the show is we want to know, like, Yo, what was the production process like for N.W.A.? Like, who was producing the group's music? Was it you or Dre? Or did y'all have to, understand that?
No, it was Dre. I mean, it was me.
Mm-hmm.
There was understanding. We didn't have to talk, but it was Dre. I mean, Dre be on the drum machine and stuff. I'm on the mixing board. Then when it's time, okay, let me run down there and program it, you know, sequence it. Because we had, you know, 808 in the, well, back then was SP-1200 during the NWA day. We sync them together. You know, we figured out how to sync all that. It wasn't samples and all this stuff. Even though the SP-1200 can sample, but we figured out to run the real 808. That's why we can get that sound we had. Oh, yeah, because when you walk in the studio, what do you see? You see me on the board, and you see Dre right in front of the drum machine. You know, that's how it went down. All the songs, we was right there, all of us together. And then everybody writing their lyrics. Most of the songs was wrote in the studio. Everything was done in the studio. We didn't make demos and all that stuff. We just did like a song a day right in the studio.
And it's wild, Yellow, because I know what a lot of the situations back in the day, if I could liken it to a lot, because I'm a big heavy metal head too, especially Bay Area thrash metal, you know, Forbidden, Testament, Exodus, Violent. I know back in the day in terms of the recording process for a lot of groups, you know, it was like, you know, the budgets were very kind of stringent, like y'all got to get in and get this thing done and get out, you know. What was it like during that time in terms of budgeting and just really making sure that everything was, like, processed? Because as, you know, you relay all this information, it's pretty much like once y'all really understood what y'all were doing with it, it wasn't hard at all to really put everything together.
Oh, yeah, because we, from the Wrecking Crew day, we learned. We learned all the machines. We learned to mix our own songs. We mixed, me and Dre mixed everything. I mean, we just learned that sound. Like when we record our drums, we record in three kicks at one time, make it fat, a couple of snares. And the key to what we did back then, we would EQ our sound as we recording it. So when we mix it down later, we EQ it again. So we got a lot of sound out of it. And we was fortunate to be on a Trident, which was a good board back then. Not the SLR, but it's right under it. And it's a good sound. And the tape machine that we recorded on, the 24-track, it recorded big rock groups from the 70s. So that machine we used had history. I forgot the name of the groups, but they're huge groups that recorded on that same machine. And it's just the sound. We knew how to get the sound. How to, you know, to EQ the mics, you know, we mix, you know, we take a day to mix a song or something. You know, we just had the ears for it. And then after all that recording, then we go get it mastered. See, that's where a lot of people, well, in the old days, they went and got their songs mastered. We used to go to Bernie Grumman, which was the top of the line back then. Michael Jackson, all of them mastered there. And we just learned that sound, how to get it, just like the SP-12. You put a little sample in, you put it in there fast so you can get more time, and then when you slow it down, it comes that dirty grit sound. Only the SP-1200 makes that sound. No other machine can do it. It's something about that SP-1200.
Yeah,
and I was saying that was also what made you guys such transitions were, I also put a lot of thought in behind making y'all records, just like y'all mixed a lot of comedy with y'all records. Like even when we listened to Eazy-E's debut album, the Eazy Does It, the first song in, they had the opener when y'all had the jokes.
The old man, that was Cube and Dre.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just, you know, I guess it was reality rap. Back then, we was like ahead of our time. You know, you put a little commercials in there. We started, I didn't know anybody else did commercials in between the songs but us.
Exactly.
We started putting them in, and they started being a little funny, and don't drink that wine from the last album commercial. I mean, we just instead of just a song fade in. No, we try to make it like a mixtape almost, where it just blends together. We always cued it, we always edited it just right, so when the song go off, the other one come in on beat or something. We did it from coming from DJs. That's how we made songs.
Yeah, man. Oh, newsflash. I just texted Jazz from HWA. She says,
uh-huh.
She says much love. She says, hey, she just wants to say how you doing and everything. So she just wanted to shout you out and just say, you know, hope all is well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh, wow, Jazz. I haven't talked to her in a long time.
We'll have to reconnect y'all, man. Great. She stand up for real. Yeah, man, I know the SP-1200s from the producer perspective. I remember, you know, when I was a youngin' listening to Showbiz
mm-hmm.
and AG's Next Level, and that's when I really started hearing about it. You know, SP-12s,
mm-hmm.
you know, so.
And
this
then,
is,
yeah, the SP-12, then the 1200 came.
Mm-hmm.
The 1200 had double, it had 10 seconds, I think, of sample time. The first one had 5.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to work it. You know, we get a kick drum or a snare drum. Or whatever we take off a song or something, so you know. But the SP-1200, we can get a little bit more into it.
Yeah,
and we also had back then it was a very expensive piece of equipment. I called it emulator, the first real sample. You could sample like whole songs and stuff. We invested in one of them, and we used that quite a bit.
Yeah, I was reading the Wu-Tang manual, and RZA, he talked about the processes in terms of all the equipment that he had with the Casio and all that, you
mm-hmm.
know, and everything that would go into being instrumental building his sound. Now, at Easy, of course, what was that like in terms of when, you know, you and Easy had connected it? Because, of course, we know the story with Easy being really instrumental in terms of having the financial resources that were
mm-hmm.
really help bring the vision to fruition. What was it like meeting Eric in those early days?
I mean, he was just a cool guy off the street, you know, just regular, you know, little short guy. And, you know, it just clicked. All of us, when we met each other, or they've been meeting, you know, it just, everything just clicked like a family, like all brothers. It was just, we wasn't all there because of business. No, we was all there to make music. And if something happened, that's cool. If it didn't, it's still cool. But he was cool. I mean, you know, down, just regular old guy, down there, dressed a little sharp, had all this feeler on and all that stuff, but he was a cool guy.
How did
bring him in
for...
Oh, go ahead,
G-Man.
Go ahead.
After the NWA and the Posse album, 2 years later, you all would just come with a monumental time bomb that would just detonate on unsuspecting ears. Straight Outta Compton was a watershed moment because it was an album to really tackle the street level perspective from Los Angeles. New York had already had, of course, the Grandmaster Flash and Furious Five, The Message. You all bought it from another level because nobody really understood West Coast life from that perspective until, I mean,
yeah.
you know, of course, y'all dropped
Yeah, I mean, because think about
it,
their songs was from
go ahead.
New York ghetto. Their songs was
right.
from New York ghetto. That's how they see it.
Mm-hmm.
We came a
mm-hmm.
totally different way. The gangs and the police, even the Grandmaster Flash, they talk about the police a little bit in a couple of songs, I remember. You know, that
right.
was just their, yeah, that was New York, that was East Coast. But West Coast was just totally different. You know, we just came from a different way, a different vibe. You know, different things going on in this ghetto.
and
y'all mixed
of course.
Y'all mixed it with humor, you know what I mean? Because...
Yeah.
Y'all would tell them, just like with Boys in the Hood, it also could seem like a funny storytelling track.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was just like I said, it was just like reality.
what we rapped about, we opened our front door, that's what we rapped about, them streets.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we knew. We didn't rap about Disneyland or New York or China. We didn't, because we never been in them places. So we just rapped about what we seen on our door. You know, cruise in the 6-4 just out here. They wasn't in New York. But in L.A., Compton, 6-4s and all of them, you know, lowriders, that's what it was. But that's what we rapped about. 8-Ball. I don't think 8-Ball was in New York.
The vernacular. Right, it wasn't a vernacular in terms of, you know, how, you know, if you was deep in the game on a block, you know, you knew, but that was something that had not reached the lexicon of the hip-hop collective and the consciousness of it yet. Now, you know, you all are in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Crack hit around 84, and that is pretty much regarded as where it really, really hit hard. Now, you're adding gangs
mm-hmm.
into it when you're already dealing with the Crips from, you know, the late 60s,
of
course, with, you know, Tukey Williams and Raymond Washington, and then a couple of years later, you know, you have the Pyrus and the Bloods that would come off of the Pyrus
mm-hmm.
From them. So, you know, this is roughly almost about 15, 16 years in where, you know, not only is the gangs already set, but now you've added this powder keg of drugs into it. What were the streets of Los Angeles like from a street level at that time in terms of what was going on out there?
I mean, to me, because we're from Compton, it's no big thing. But to me, the gang stuff really didn't get crazy looking into After Colors. Seemed like it just...
1988, Oliver Stone.
The movie,
yeah.
It just seemed like it just... Well, when that came out, it went all around the state, it's, you know, all other countries. I mean, not countries, but other states and stuff. That went crazy. But in 84, you know, once that hit the ghetto, oh, my God. That is one drug that ruined families. I mean, ruined whole families. Just like, wow. It's just like amazing. Even my brother was hooked on it for 35 years. 35.
Wow.
And he got off of it in one day. One day. When a person gets tired of it, they can get off of it if they want to. That's if they want to. But, yeah, 84 is just the gangs. Because I graduated in 80. And the gangs, you know, was a very a handful of gangs. But once it started getting to 84 and all that, that's when the gangs seemed like they start growing a little bit until the later 80s when it started to get real, you know, big. You know, like I said, when the movie Colors came out, it just exploded then. That's when all the gang members want to be on CNN and all this stuff, you know, all kinds of stuff. It got exposed, and it just the world just was caught. They didn't know what to do.
Yeah, and that was, you know, when we were shorties when Colors came out in 88. I remember watching it, and I, King, you know, my brother, he's from North Carolina. I'm from Virginia. You know, so we were too young at the time to really, really, really understand, you know. And what made it wild about it, Yellow, was when we look at it from that era, is the game progressed in music, you know, and on off the cuff. We just try to be historically as accurate as we can, but we never say anything to incriminate or, you know, to, you know, sensationalize. When we look at it, you know, Ice-T, you know, we know he was repping the blue side, Hoover. You know, we know Easy was, you know, Kelly Park along with Ren.
Yeah.
You know, so, but this was something that back in the day, you know, even with y'all music, you know, you talked about it, but there was never really any alluding to, you know, sets or whatever, you know.
Yeah, because we was kind of, we were just neutral.
Right.
You know, we didn't say the blood, the cuz. We didn't pick a side. No, we were just neutral. All we did, we were just underground reporters telling it what's going on. That's what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, that's why the cursing and all that, the hard lyrics, we just reported it as, you know, what we see or what goes on. You know, we never said in the records, because we wasn't a political group at all. Public Enemy, that's totally different. But we wasn't political
right,
at all.
Right.
We might have been ghetto political. we're just talking about the ghetto, and yeah, we didn't pick no side. You know, none at all. That's just, we were just neutral. We, you know, we can relate to either side. It didn't matter.
So the way y'all did the, because this was confusing to me at first, like how y'all
uh-huh.
went straight out of Compton and Easy does it. So were all the songs,
mm-hmm.
y'all were just recording the records, and y'all was going to, the records that it made Easy does it, y'all was going to put on straight out of Compton?
No, it was, I figured out how we made the song, the album, straight out of Compton in a month, less than a month. When we did,
oh, wow.
If you look at Easy's album, the cover, you look at it, that's an N.W.A. cover with everybody on it.
Right.
But somebody, I don't know who it was, Dre, I don't know who it was, came up and said, why don't we make two groups out of the one? That'd be double the money. So that was a brilliant idea. So we, Easy's album, we did that. And then we did the Straight Outta Compton. What it was, Straight Outta Compton had some of the singles that we made earlier. We just pulled them and put them on the album. You know, even, you know, some of the songs we did remixes for and stuff like that. But they was, some of the songs was old already. So it was just like, it's the same group, but we just split it up into two.
Now, in terms of photography for it, I believe you, the individual who did that was Eric Poppleton and Kevin Hoffman.
Which one?
Photographer and art director, respectfully. Yes, is that exactly who they were?
Which cover?
For Straight Outta Compton, the record cover.
I don't remember who it was, because I remember that cover, that picture was not the cover for the album. They wanted to use another cover. We was in the alley. It was the same day. We was in the alley walking, and they was leaning towards that picture. Because the picture that was taken for that cover, it only was like four or five shots of it. It wasn't very many taken. The guy just got on the ground, and we just stood around, and he just took him. Because he didn't even light it up or anything.
Mm.
And that picture was not meant for the cover. Not at all.
Are we getting exclusive with this? Because I don't think anybody else has ever known that story.
Because I used to go up to Priority all the time, you know, just to check on things. And I remember, when they was working on the cover, it was the other picture they was looking at, and I remember seeing that picture. And I remember saying, oh, that's a nice album cover-looking picture, and that's all I mentioned about it. And then once the record got done, that was the album cover. So evidently somebody picked that, because that was not the original cover. They wasn't picking that. They was picking something else.
Mm-hmm.
See, I remember a lot of this stuff back then.
But I think what made that cover resonate so much, Yella, was that it was raw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know a little bit about photography, but it was untouched. It wasn't edited.
Yeah.
It was just a dude laying down, shooting a camera up with a gun pointing at him.
Yeah,
it
and
was
he didn't
just
even have nothing to lay on. He laid in the dirt. The dirt, or I'm trying to think, was it a parking lot? I can't remember where it was. I remember he just laid down. He didn't lay nothing down to lay on it. He laid down, took four, five, maybe six shots. And I think that was all the pictures taken of that. He didn't have no lights, nothing. He just took it. And it just became in, like, I guess, an iconic picture. It's different. Nobody else had made a cover like that at all. It was just totally different. And he had the little starter pistol in his hand, but nobody knew it was a starter pistol, but it looked great.
Right, visual.
Even the even our clothing, we wasn't dressed in black. Everybody was wearing what they was wearing. Me, I had an Angels jersey and a Laker jacket.
But sometimes the best surprises, they just come spontaneous, you know. And that's what made it
something
work.
Like that, like in a recording studio. Something you do mm-hmm. something accidentally, sometimes you're like, oh, we're keeping that. Sometimes that happens a lot. It just, you know, like you said, it just spur the moment pictures or something. It just come out the best. if we were to try to plan to shoot that shot, it wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have came out like that one. That one was not planned at all. Or spur of the moment. I remember it.
Hey, you know, you know, continuing with the Straight Outta Compton album, I got to say that was probably what I would call, like, the two-piece. Like, y'all hit us with two-piece, like, with the hard, with the Straight Outta Compton single. Then you hit the F the Police, two of the hardest records. Yeah, you hit us, like, with the two-piece right there. So you know we had to stay glued as the listener.
It was just. Now, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, now, with recording F the Police, man, like, what was the true motivation behind that? Like, with that experience that you guys personally went through?
I know I've been jacked by the police. We even been jacked, just like the movie, not exactly like that, but we've been jacked in front of the studio because the studio was in Torrance. And our color don't supposed to be out at night in Torrance. That's a place where if you with your homies, you don't drive through Torrance, even to this day.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
We've been jacked in front of the studio. We jacked in front of the studio. Once they found out that we was in there musicians or something, they didn't do it no more. That's why they even let us one day when they got that picture of us sitting on the front of the police car. That was in front of the studio. But, yeah, we've been jacked, you know, just jacked for nothing. You know, you standing around, police, boom, on the car and all that. So, but what we did, we didn't create nothing new on that song. That people have been wanting to say that for years. Think about it. Back then, people wasn't bold enough to say it to the cops because you'd get cracked in the mouth if you say something like that to the cops. Nowadays, they all in their face saying it. It's nothing now. They can do it anyway. But back then, we just made a song that for years, since the 70s, since the 60s, people been wanting to say that to the cops' face or point the finger at the cops. We just did it. We didn't do it to make it controversial. We just did the song. We did something that a lot of people wanted to say.
You know, and I think it resonates so much.
Hey, T-Man, I had to add this to it right here while we talking about this topic.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, we know that Rick James, he did the song on Mr. Policeman, which, you know, that addressed, you know, the issues with police in the black community.
Mm-hmm.
So what made you guys different, y'all had the whole skit in the beginning, like the judge and the jury.
Yeah.
And y'all just laid it all like, fuck the police. You know what I'm saying? And it was just more bold.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's just something that people been wanting to say. But you just back in them days, you just didn't say that. Yeah, you say that around your buddies and stuff, but you don't say that too much in public back then. That's why the FBI ended up sending us a letter. You know, we kind of like crossed the line here. But it was within our rights, but we crossed the line.
But I tell you, Yella, and Fuck the Police was a powerful record, but I think we have to look at that song in terms of the template that it was laid behind in historical context. This is where the O.J. documentary Made in America comes in, because when you look at the history of Los Angeles in terms of what was going on with Daryl Gates as the chief of police department, if I got my historical facts right, he was the person who would lay down the the 6 a.m., door knockdowners known as the SWAT team. He was actually, I believe, the one who actually, instituted the foundation that would become what we know as SWAT teams and crash teams.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and then
and
I mean,
the
Bat-A-Round,
if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
The Bat-A-Round. They were tearing houses up.
Yeah, so and also, Yella, we're not even getting into the part about when we're looking at all the, all the things that were going on in LA, like with the Watts riots in the 60s and all that. So there was already that tension, that abhorrence, that outright disdain for not only law enforcement, but seemingly the establishment in general. So what you know, y'all music did at that time was it articulated that urban sentiment, that anger, that frustration, that revolutionary spirit that would make that song so iconic.
Now think about this. It was
so iconic.
30 years later, it's the number one downloaded song during all the riot, not the riots, but all the George Floyd stuff. It was just, you know, that song still was like fresh and new to the people because the same thing been going on forever. It ain't stopped. Ain't going to stop. That song will last probably another 100 years.
Take us through that process of Straight Outta Compton in terms of recording. I mean, with, of course, Express Yourself, Fuck the Police, I mean, all of that. I mean, you know, dope.
Oh, yeah, it was just like, because that's when the docs start coming around and start writing these parts. And E liked them, liked the way he wrote. It was different from Cube and Ren's style, different, because Doc came with a different flow. I mean, it was so funky the way he write. He liked his lyrics. But, you know, we did Straight Outta Compton, The Police Song. Then Express Yourself, that was Dre's first really time rapping on that album. But he had rapped with him and Ren on a couple of other songs, Compton in the House and stuff like that. We actually, Compton in the House was an old song that we remixed it for that album. Parental Discretion, the one where I played the drums on. And that one, you know, we just did our thing on there. It was just, we made it so fast, and I just didn't really realize. I'm like, wow, we had a lot of old songs. We put a lot of old songs that we had already done on there. But
how many
songs
did y'all record during that period?
Like whatever you hear on records, that's what we recorded. There was no extra songs laying around. Because we didn't make demos. We made them day by day. We go to studio Monday through Friday, 12 o'clock to about 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock maybe. We wouldn't know all-nighters and stuff like that. By 8 o'clock, we out the studio. It was just like a set program every day. So we would have, you know, we would have the studio booked up. Nobody else can get in. So we had it blocked out. And we just went in there day by day, did the tracks and all that, and then everybody go in their little corners, not E, of course, he didn't write nothing, but everybody go in their corners and write their lyrics, and then, bam, come back, and song's done. A day, that's all it took. You know, not no take it home, listen to the tape, and all. Nah, them songs was done right then, right on the spot. And not a lot of takes on them, too. Like the DOC, when he did parts, he was a one-take wonder. He could do it one take and boom, he's done. You ain't got to do him no more. Cube and all of them, you know, very few punches. But E, that's a whole nother subject there, you know.
I saw the footage.
We have a whole subject just on that by itself. Because he
that
just wasn't a natural rapper.
Right, right.
I mean, but he had the sound, he had the look, and his lyrics just was raw. So it's just like, wow. But if he had the battle, nah. he couldn't. He barely remembered a word from the song when we did shows, so
he just wasn't a natural, he wasn't a rapper.
But he had that sound, and the words was wrote just right, and it just, wow. Because people thought he was, people thought he was 16 or something, rapping.
Yeah.
Because he just
cause of that pitch,
it in one of the songs.
Pitch.
And they stayed with that for a long time. Or 15. Yeah, that was the age. 15. They thought he was 15 years old.
Yeah, because of his size and his pitch.
Yeah. Wow. Man. them was the golden age of music. That era, because you had all the Public Enemies, Run DMC, LL. I mean, it just
KRS,
the Two Shorts. I mean, it was just, it wasn't too many groups back then.
Everybody with different sound, different style, talk about different things. We talk about this. Too Short talk about that. P.E. talk about that. Run MC talked about that. You know, everybody, it was just all different. It wasn't oversaturated with groups like nowadays. It's so many groups. You know, it's so easy to make songs now. You know, back then we had to create the sound. We couldn't just go pull it off of YouTube or something like that, Google it and stuff like that. We had to, all the groups, they had to just do stuff from scratch. Yeah.
And, you know, and we're going to the golden era, and this is where, you know, a lot of people feel that the game didn't change is when hip-hop started becoming more corporate. And when they start finding mm-hmm. that there's money to be involved, this is where, you know, usually in America, when things go corporate, things go down south. So
yeah,
a question I want to pitch to you is about when Jerry Heller came into the scene. And did it change mm-hmm. the dynamic of you guys' relationship?
No. Because Jerry was there at the tail end of the Wrecking Crew. He came in, Lonzo brought him in from somewhere. So he came in at the tail end right before we left the Wrecking Crew. And he got us one big show in London, which was a Fresh Fest out there.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he got us on the Fresh Fest. I think it was 85, 84, one of them years, the Fresh Fest. So then E brought him around when we started doing the Ruthless stuff. But Jerry got us the deals and got us all these deals at these different labels, you know, distribution deal, Priority. And then J.J. Fad, they was on Atlantic. And then they started being a lot of deals. But the problem with him that we were just, you know, we all was young. There was no paperwork and stuff. You think about
right.
that. We did all these songs. Our first piece of paperwork was in 89, in the middle of the tour. That's the first time we signed some contracts. And that's when Q left at that time. I mean,
right.
that was the first
right.
paperwork we seen. It wasn't that E was dirty or nothing like that. No. E was just like us. He learned it just like us. Now, the problem with I call him Mr. Manager. The problem was he was getting 20% of the group. Okay, we can deal with that. That's no problem. But he was also getting 20% of the label.
What?
That's the conflict of interest right there.
Yeah.
Is it dirty
now,
or is it just, you
now,
know.
Now, Yellow,
but we being
Yellow, before
young,
we go.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Yeah, now, before we go on with that, because we don't want to break your train of thought, but we got to ask you this question. Now, there's always
mm-hmm.
been a debate about Ruthless Records in terms of who really was running it. Was it Easy or Jerry's label?
No, E, it was all E. There was nobody.
Okay.
It was all
okay.
E. It wasn't, I don't care what, I don't know where all that, they was both, nah. It was all
got
E.
You.
But see, this is the thing got about E. E was not dirty. In my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know. It's like this. Millions of dollars or whatever is coming in. The young guy out the ghetto, you know. So whatever was pushed in front of him to sign, he didn't know what he was signing.
Gotcha.
You know, he's just like, oh, sign this. So, you know, it's the older person that's been around music for years, decades, that knew how to, I ain't saying being crooked, but knew how to do whatever he did.
Make it work.
Like I said, he
make
did both sides.
Right.
Yeah, 20% from here, 20% from there. So when I did this J.J. Fad's second album, I remember, Dre didn't want to do it, so I had to do it. And I went to the manager to say, hey, you know, about getting paid. He told me, go ask Z. I'm like, ain't you the manager? So that's what I'm saying. It's just like, we didn't have our own managers as groups.
Mm-hmm.
The label didn't have its own manager as a label. You know, own lawyers. We didn't see. We were so young, and I guess we was talented or something. You know, we was making so many records back to back to back to back. Think about this. Ruthless was really only 4 years with the hits.
Right.
By the time
right.
we finally got off the first couple of singles and stuff. Once we started doing J.J. Fad's gold single, gold album, we was rolling back to back to back. There was no paperwork during all them days. And then in the middle of the tour, this the first time, you know, the manager came on tour. He didn't go on tour with us, no. He came out the one time, and that's when the contracts was there. And, you know, a young kid, and they offering $75,000 check to sign. I picked the contract up, flipped it over, signed it. Give me my check. You know, we was young. We didn't know nothing. But I guess Cube didn't sign his, and that's when he left, you know, after that tour. So that's what I'm saying. It wasn't E that was crooked. No. He didn't even know what was going on. I'm quite sure he didn't. Not at all. We were just got taken advantage of. That's
right.
How I see it. We just, you know, somebody manipulated the situation. Oh, they don't
right.
know nothing. They don't know. They don't know about publishing, producers, writers, all this kind of different ways to get paid off of one song. We didn't know all that stuff. But we had to learn. We had to learn the hard way, but we learned.
Those years, because the story goes pretty much after, because I want to ask you, being the direct source who was involved, and then, you know, of course, correlating this with the movie, because, of course, in the scene, you know, where Cube is talking to Jerry, you know, of course, O'Shea talking to, of course, Paul Giamatti, you know, they're mm-hmm. speaking about, you know, where he's talking about what's really going on with this money. And Cube said this in Beef 3 when he was talking about what was going on in terms of the money wasn't right. And I'm wondering, you know, the thing is, why is it, you know, he's getting so much and we're not getting anything? And, of course, like you said, that was a situation. There was no paperwork. So Cube had never officially signed to the group, and that's how he was
yeah.
able to leave when he did. Now, the situation, now, Cube had called you about that in terms of asking, did you want to come with him when all of this came?
Not Cube. That was Dre.
Dre. Dre called you. Right. Now, when Dre was leaving, now when Dre would end up leaving, he called you about it after Dre saw what was going on with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously, because we still have to get into the whole part after Cube left about what were the dynamics with the group in terms of what was going on. Because obviously, for obvious reasons, there was a lot of acrimony and hostility until everybody saw the
group.
Okay, go ahead.
I put it like, I wouldn't say hostility. I wouldn't. To me,
okay.
The reason why the group broke up, even Cube,
okay.
even Dre, why it dissolved, broke up, was outsiders looking at the inside.
Gotcha.
The inside
gotcha.
Is us, the five. That's the us. That's the five. There was no
right.
problems between us that I've
got
gotcha. No arguments, no nothing. But it was outsiders. Seeing what they can get or what they can come up off of or whatever their reason was. That's what broke the group up. It wasn't us
gotcha.
Arguing and breaking it. No. It was the outsiders, the looky-loos, whatever, whoever it was. That's what destroyed the group. But I put it on this note. It was better that Cube left, and it was better that when Dre left, the group dissolved. It wasn't even a breakup, it just dissolved. It was better for them
yep.
in their careers.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing. That group had to break up. Think about this. It had to break up, then come back 30 years later and make a number one movie, and then Hall of Fame, and then all this stuff, reselling the songs like it was brand new again. It had to break up then. We broke up at number one on the Billboard. Number one.
You went out on top.
We had just,
you went out on top.
We had just shipped gold. That was unheard of for hip-hop groups back then.
Mm-hmm.
The ship to come out the box gold, that was just, and we broke up at that while we were up there. So it's just an amazing story. All that and still 30 years later, the group is still getting talked about. And still, how many groups done that? I don't know very many. I don't know any. Even rock and roll groups, heavy metal. I mean, how many have did that? Usually they break up when they going downhill at the bottom of the truck, so not even on the truck. Not at number one.
But Yella, look at the tree that broke off from that. I mean, you know, we have Snoop Dogg. We got Dubs. You know, I mean,
now think
you know,
about
I
this
mean,
before you go down that trail. Before you go down that trail, think about this. Go back before music. Me and Dre DJ. Me and Dre started doing music first. We was the egg. Me and Dre. We was the egg. And think of all that came out of that egg once you crack it. Snoop, Eminem, 50 Cent, Q, E, Dre. I mean, so much came out of that. Michelle H, JJ said, it's so many. Warren G, it's so many. Wow.
Gang.
It's just,
I mean,
all that came from back.
Kendrick, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's so many, it's hard to even name them all.
We can't name
it's
them all.
That much.
I mean, and not 10.
Yeah, and it came from that one little egg. Two guys looking at
I'll
a
take
Run
it even
DMC
further.
Show. Yeah.
Two I'll take it even further.
Two guys.
The whole priority records, the whole priority records roster. Y'all made
priority
records.
It was, all they had was the California Raisins. That's all priority had was California Raisins. It was platinum, but that's all they had. They didn't have nothing else. That's why E picked priority because they can work harder. The big labels, capitals, and all that, they ain't working hard for it. No, they got too much going on. Too much going on. Now, think about this. All this came from when me and Dre was looking at Run DMC. They came to the L.A. for the first time at our club. We DJing, and we watched a 10-minute show. We see him. I think it was just Sucker MCs. They did the show, 10 minutes. They threw the mics down and folded their hands. That was their show. And me and Dre looked at each other and said, that's it? That's all it takes to make music? That's it? And we did music. That was the beginning. That was the beginning. And look what came from it. I mean, oh, my God. Bone Thugs and Harmony. I mean, so much done came from it. It's just crazy.
Now, I got a question shot to me here in regards to the Niggas for Life album. Tim Perkins from Kylie, he wanted to know, what was the process like creating the second album? Budget-wise, did it feel like shit reaching to another level? And also, creatively, how different was the approach from the first album, if any, outside of Cube not being there?
It was, the first one was a challenge. Can we be anything without Cube? So Cube was one-third of the voice that was gone. So it's like, can we do that? And on that album, even though Straight Outta Compton was a better album, but production-wise, the second album was better. We grew up. The production skills grew on that album. Much fatter music, more sound. It's just way better because we use less samples because we were the poster child of the lawsuit for samples from our album, from Straight Outta Compton. So that album used less samples, but it was a much better produced, bigger. Well, I wouldn't say if it was a bigger budget because we did the same thing. We just had the studio blocked out. So we just did albums. It might have took a month and a half, 2 months, maybe about 2 months, maybe. But it was just, we grew up. The sound grew up. Everything. It's just a much better produced, mixed, everything album. It was more harder.
Ask you this, Yellow. Was this around the time Above the Law? Would Above the Law come in around this time helping y'all out with the sound, or would they come later on in terms of that?
Dre had did their album. But they wasn't in the studio with us unless on the commercial when they came and did some vocals on the intro.
Yes, sir.
On the intro. Producer-wise, no, they wasn't in the studio. But they had did their album. Dre had did their album.
Got you.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and now, not to mention, Ren stepped up big time on the mic, too. I mean, he was never no slouch, but he was a straight assassin on that joint.
To me, Ren was the strongest voice in the group. He had the strongest voice. He had the sound. Cube had the style. But then once Cube left, Dre had to step up and fill them shoes.
Mm-hmm.
He definitely had to step up. But, Ren, he came hard. I mean, the tracks was just harder. The tracks was much harder.
Yeah.
But the Straight Outta Compton is more popular than that album. Because it just, you can't beat the original. You just cannot beat the original. Even though the second one sounds, make that one sound like nothing. But you just can't beat that original.
Yeah, sonically, y'all was on point with it. And y'all, between the skits and...
Yeah.
Being that you was part of that album, did you guys get a ton load of flack for that? Because I can't imagine, like, you know, with the songs and the direction you guys went for that album.
I don't...
This was a nine.
somebody actually, either the whole album or a song, I think it was the whole album, how many times you said the N-word. Somebody counted them. I forgot how many it was, but somebody actually, I think it was a song, maybe, or something. I was just like, wow, somebody really did that. Counted every word. That song, that album was really raw. I mean, it was just, but it was polished.
I mean, Appetite for Destruction, Real Niggas, Automobile.
Oh, yeah. She Swallowed.
Always into something.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
I mean, even a skip with One Less Bitch would have landed it there.
Yeah.
Man, he's like, what the fuck wrong with you, man? Shooting this bitch in my shit.
Yeah.
You said I was got to call the first.
I like the Don't Drink This Wine. Oh, my God. It's just so much. Wow. Always into something. It's just, man, that was a classic album there, too.
Yes, it was.
That was a classic album.
Yes, it was.
It didn't sell like, it went platinum, but it didn't do triple and stuff like the Straight Outta Compton. I don't know why. It just, I guess we broke up all at the same time, so somehow I got lost in the wash. But it was still a platinum album, but it should have been double.
Kind of,
at least double.
The split with Cube played a role?
Wait a minute, what was that again?
You think the split with Ice Cube played a role in the album? You feel like it's not going triple or quadruple?
You know something? I don't know. That's a hard question. I could imagine him being on that album, too. It had just been unheard of. Then it might have blew Straight Outta Compton out the water.
Mm-hmm.
If Q would have been on that album.
Right.
It might have just made Straight Outta Compton like it was a kid's toy. But, I mean, it still held its ground. It did.
Oh, yeah.
Those rounds. Definitely.
Now, before we go a little further, Yella, I got to ask you this from you being an industry veteran in terms of just getting your opinion on what it's like today. When artists come into the game now, what you mentioned earlier, and we really want to get your extended opinion, your knowledge, you know, your wisdom on this. How important is it for artists to understand what they are signing coming into the game? And number two, how important is it for them to watch who is around them on their day-to-day, not only their business aspects, but just who's around them in general in terms of just influence and productivity?
Well, I'll answer the second one first. The problem nowadays with people around them, they got phones everywhere, cameras everywhere. So they're posting everything, you know. So you could either do something great or you could do something bad and be all over everywhere. So that's like, wow. Social media is just something else. Now, to answer the first question, lawyer, that's the key to everything. Entertainment, music, doesn't matter. It's a lawyer. You need a lawyer to look at stuff. So he could tell you about publishing. Publishing is 200%. Music, 100%. Mm. Lyrics, 100%. Most of people don't know that. Then you got producer credit. You got artists. Mechanical, it's so, well, they don't really sell actual pieces no more, so the mechanicals may not be there no more, but it's so much to one record. The one that owns the publishing is the one that makes all the money, or keep on making money later down when a movie want to use a song or something like that.
Or a commercial.
It's the publishing. Yeah, it's publishing, but do the movie use the real song? See, then you get paid for that. If they use an original song, like our movie, it used original song. So that's, you know, that's like getting paid all over from the beginning. But it's so many ways, but the key word is lawyer. I ain't talking about no manager. We talking about a lawyer. A manager will get you in a whole bunch of mess.
Yeah.
They think they a lawyer, but they ain't.
And we're going and Yella, we're gonna get into the movie later. We want to talk a little bit about you in terms of actually what happened, you know, after you left, after the group dissolved and you all went your separate ways, because you found yourself in another profession that I think we all can appreciate and really enjoy. A lot of us, how we learned our stroke game from, you know, to please the ladies out there. How did you find yourself coming into the adult film industry?
Well, it my buddy Big Man, he originally went to E. This was after Dre left. He went to E and asked him, do you want to shoot adult movies? E never gave him an answer. He came to me. I said, yeah, okay, let's do it. Just like that. It wasn't even a thought or nothing. Because I jumped into it not to see the girls. It was, I jumped into it as producer, just like a producer of a record. I jumped into it as a filmer. You know, I went and bought the cameras, the steel camera, the computer, the edit. I did everything. Put the hip-hop music into it. So I went in as a business. And I did that once E died on his funeral day. They just put the dirt, pounded it in the ground, and I stood right there on the grave, next to the grave. I didn't stand on the grave, but next to the grave, and I said, I'm done with music. Just like that. Wasn't even a thought. Wasn't even a second thought. From that day on, I did adult movies for 15 years, over 350 movies. And that's just a small estimate, I think. Yeah, over
Fat Dog Productions,
movies.
Right?
Huh?
Fat Dog Productions.
No,
like
no, Fat Dog was just one of the distributors.
Okay, one distributor.
Mine
got
was
you.
Called Low Key, but I had Hidden Beat. I mean, not Hidden Beat, but I had all kind of distributors. I had like four or five different distributors.
Oh, you
and
were
I was
paid.
Making movies for every month.
You were
doing it. I was doing it. Oh, yeah. Because I jumped. I didn't jump in it for the fun. I jumped in it as business. So every movie I make was like producing a song or an album. That's just how I looked at it. You know, it just, bam, for 15 years. Until it dried up in like 08. That's when the internet starting to get big, and then you could find the content all over the internet for free. So nobody was buying the stuff no more. So that's when I said, I'm done with this. And it was that easy. I just stopped.
But that's wild, though, because you know what, Yella? The thing is, even with, you know, in full disclosure, because like I said, I have nothing but the utmost appreciation for what y'all do, but even some of the stuff out there now, like the 24/7 series and all that, like that stuff is hard to find now on physicals. You know,
oh, really?
So there's no telling. Yeah.
I've done so many different lines. Oh, my God. I can't even think of the name. I even made my last project was called Straight Outta Compton. This was like 08. I made two movies, Straight Outta Compton Part 1, Part 2. This was years before the movie was even thought of.
Yeah, DJ Yella's. Yeah, I remember seeing it. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can't find that nowadays. Because when the movie came out, it just seemed like you couldn't find that no more. Like they
the copyright,
took it off
the copyright.
Yeah, something. Something they did that you could not find. And you just, okay.
Now, talking about, I had to leave for a second. Y'all talking about, like, physicals and copies?
No,
yeah,
like the actual DVDs.
The
tapes, VHS tapes, yeah. Once 08 came around, people wasn't buying the pieces no more. They can go get it downloaded for free online and stuff. So that's what killed that business for me. It's still going on, I guess. But that's when I said, I'm done with that one. Just like music. 2 seconds I said I was done with music, and I was done with that. I didn't even think about it, didn't come back to it, nothing at all. I cleaned my hands with it, I was done.
But that's a testament to it, Yella, because when we watched the Defiant Ones with Jimmy Iovine and Dre, of course, you know, interviewing, they said about Jimmy, that is the one thing with Jimmy Iovine that made him so successful. He got to the zenith of what he was going to accomplish, and he was able to just stop it and move to something else. And you've done the same thing. In show business, we call it the second act. And, you know, you have been so successful. Tell us about, because we still haven't got to the movie yet, and we're going to, but tell us about, you know, the book, your autobiography that you released this summer, because now we can add author to your already impressive and legendary credentials.
Yeah. Author? Me? Wow. I never even opened a book before in my life. Never. Still to this day, I have not opened a book and read one at all. And it just, during the whole pandemic, it was a year and a half, it just came to me to write the book. And I didn't write it because the movie didn't have my character that much in the movie. I liked the movie. It had nothing to do with that. I just wrote my story. This is my story. And then Wrecking Crew NWA happened to be in my story. Before Wrecking Crew, during Wrecking Crew, before NWA, the breakup, Easy, that, all that, all the way up into, from 4 or 5 years old, all the way up until 2020. My whole life. And a lot of the missing puzzles and pieces is in that book. It's just,
wow.
I just said how it went. This is what happened. This is how it happened. Not to make me look all like bad or something like that. No, this is just how it happened. When I met Dre, everything, you know, just the breakups, when they left, and when Dre called me about leaving, and I didn't give him an answer. I didn't give him an answer to that question when he said he was leaving. I did not give him an answer till 2019 when I went to his house. That's when I gave him an answer. And I didn't have an answer. I was just caught in the middle of Dre was leaving. I really didn't know what was going on. And I was just there. I didn't say, oh, okay, I'm going to stay with E. No, I didn't make a decision. I didn't give no decision.
Gotcha.
I just got put into the situation. That's all it was. I just got put into that. But all that's in the book. I mean, all of it. And people that read it, they like the book. Amazon, it got 5 stars and stuff. So, but, you know, I just tell my story in order with pictures, all kind of stuff.
And, you know,
a lot of those pictures,
you know,
I've never seen before. That's what makes the book stand out as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've been... just been having them pictures, you know, just sitting there for the longest. Because I was the only one that was really taking the pictures back then. You know, because everybody didn't have a cell phone like nowadays and all that. But I was the only one that was really kind of taking pictures and keeping pictures. So they were just sitting around. I'm like, why am I keeping all these pictures? But now I know the reason why. It was for the book.
Yeah, and you know what, Yella, it's important because over the past year, we have lost so many hip-hop legends, you know, in the past 3-4 years. I mean, we've lost Shock G, we've lost Prodigy, we've lost DMX, we've lost Prince Marky D, you know, we've lost Andre Harrell, you know.
Oh, really?
We've lost, you know, I mean, Yeah, you know, Chucky Thompson. And this is why your archives in written text are so important to the culture, because
mm-hmm.
you mean so much to all of us. I don't want to get overly emotional saying it, but you mean so much to all of us for what you all gave us in terms of how you all gave a voice to the oppressed, to the ignored, to the downtrodden,
mm-hmm.
to the hood in general. We can't thank you enough
yeah.
for that. And to have your story is something that is essential reading, because to really understand the history, the fabric of this culture we have all grown into and love so much,
mm-hmm.
your story is something that needs to be told. And we're just glad that, you know, you're still here with us, and you were
yeah.
here with us to write it. Because
yeah.
this is, I mean, you're one of the MVPs of so many living legends in the game, and we this is one of the reasons why this show is so special for us, because we want to give
mm-hmm.
you our flowers of appreciation to you while you're here. To Easy posthumously, to Dre, to Ren,
yeah.
to Q, to all of you for what you have contributed and given us and the world.
I mean, it's, you know, it's so crazy. It's just amazing. I'm just sitting here looking at the book on the bed, and it's just like that book has the history of, kind of the history of L.A. hip-hop scene.
Because
it was before that scene started. And I put in how I got into it and all that with the beats. The beefs with the Uncle Jam's Army, which was a rival crew for the Wrecking Crew.
So really
Egypt and all them, that was rival stuff.
What works for you and listen, right?
So it's,
like,
it's just, it's a lot of story in there.
Yeah, I love what you said. Like, it's
yeah.
like you make sure that.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, okay.
Now the movie. When you all were collectively approached about a biopic that was actually going to be produced, because we, you know, the movie was released in 2015, and, you know, we had heard about it a couple years before. What was that
mm-hmm.
like in terms of, you know, really, like, how did that hit you? Like, wow, our
well,
story is really going to
well,
be told.
I wasn't in that process. I was not in that process. They came to me after all that.
Okay.
After all, it's in the book too. So they
mm-hmm.
they came to me after all that. I wasn't
gotcha.
In none of that. So I have no idea, you know, what was going on. I remember Q telling me that Universal picked the movie up, and that was in 2013. He said
right.
it's going to be about a year before they start, which they filmed in 2014. And I didn't talk to their lawyers until 2014, January
mm-hmm.
2014. You know, they offered me, you know, I don't want to say nothing bad. They offered me something.
Got you.
You know,
got you.
It's something.
We're not going to get in your pocket.
It was something.
Got you.
I put it like this. I couldn't retire on it. But that was it. I mean, you know, I told them about the studio scene, not the scene, but what was in the equipment we used. That's about all I did. You know, because I guess nobody else remembered all the equipment and what kind of studios, what they looked like. So I did a little of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, told them what machines, how the studio looked, this and that. But that was about it. That was about it. And one thing Cube asked me about the day before shooting, when they shot the scene of the when the diss song came out, and my character said, "They got us." I told him that's what I said back then. You know,
right.
Even though the scene looked like that, it wasn't a scene like that. But I remember, and I told him, he said, "What happened? Because I wasn't there." I said, "Well, I just said, you got us. That was it. Well, nothing else to be said. You got us." Because he made a whole song about us. We only took pop shots at him.
Right.
So that was it. That was my consulting job. But I liked the movie. The movie was great to me. I ain't mad at it, but that's all I did.
But one thing about it in a historical context,
mm-hmm.
but one thing in a historical context, Yella, was before anything, King and myself, we want the youngins out there because we lived through that era. So we really
mm-hmm.
know the significance, the monumental contributions you all made. We want the
mm-hmm.
youngins out there to really understand what you all meant and how legendary you are. And I think the movie, because when we saw it, we were like, we were not, you know, disappointed at all. We were like, as far
mm-hmm.
as we knew, because like you say, you know, back in the day, we didn't have social media, you know, the magazines
yeah.
it were really like the source. Source was just starting out back in 88.
Yeah.
You know, shout out to
oh,
Dave
yeah.
Mays, Don Schechter, you know. You know, of course, with Word Up Magazine, shout out to John Blasting Gang.
Yeah.
You know, the for that. You know, so this is these are like publications that really we were getting our hip-hop information from.
Oh,
so
yeah.
This was something for, I think, the youth to really understand their history and, like we say, do the knowledge, understand
yeah.
what
oh,
was going on at the scene.
Oh, yeah. And that movie created a whole new era of fans, much younger. I mean,
mm-hmm.
20-year-olds and stuff like, oh, man, I just grew up. I'm like, 20? You ain't even thought of. But that movie opened the eyes. I don't think it was just the eyes. Because of the social media, it's so worldwide, so instantly. It was around the world. It was just like, wow. You know, and I went to a couple of theaters to look at the movie the first weekend. And I was just going to the movie theater. Nobody knew I was coming or nothing. I just watched. And I said, wow, was we really that big like that? You know, it's just amazing to see your story. And that's another amazing thing is that they made a story about us. Five people from Compton, from the ghetto or something, and they made a story about us. That's just amazing to me.
Now, we got to ask you all this question.
Think
was
about
the, was it. Was the road really that wild and like it was in the movie where y'all was on
I
tour?
Mean,
was it really that crazy?
See, just like my book, I throw myself under the bus. So I ain't going to throw nobody else under the bus. For me,
okay.
it was. I can throw myself under the bus. Yeah, I mean, the role was it for me. I mean, that was life.
Oh, man. That, oh, wow. We can only imagine. I mean, the world's most dangerous group.
Yeah, you can't imagine just looking at yourself at the big screen. I ain't talking about a local TV role, but, you know, having
yeah.
the autobiography done in your life, that's like that's a milestone stuff right there.
Yeah.
Somebody playing
that
me.
Was, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's kind of weird. It's kind of like, wow. What? Wow, I mean, it was the number one bio, you know, musical. Until the last one that just knocked us off, Rap City or whatever that last one was. But I'm just like, really? On the big screen, Universal? Because I took my kids, before the movie came out, I took them to Universal Studios. And I'm just looking around. I didn't really put two and two together. And I'm looking around. I'm looking on the walls. I'm like, wait a minute, that's our poster. I look on another wall. I'm like, I forgot. Universal made the movie. And you can see it all over Universal Studio. I'm just like, now that was just amazing. Whoever would have thought that we would have been doing something like that? Even the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We never thought of that when we did the music back then. It never was even thought, just to make it a few bucks. That's all it was. Not even a gold record, not even triple platinum, none of that. That wasn't even a thought. At all. We never made a song that said, oh, we're going to go platinum on this. We never did that.
It was just y'all just expressing y'all stories.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We just said it like it was.
Those that are influenced by your music far and wide, Jeezy, the late great Nipsey Hussle, Mozzie, Kendrick, you know, Cam and China, Compton AV, AD, Jay Stylin, you know, Gucci Mane, you know, they because they all have that, you know, that street element that really comes in there more. When you look at the hip-hop rap game today, how do you feel about the culture in terms of where it has changed to in terms of what we're seeing now? Who are some of the artists out there, no matter the genre, who you really, really, really enjoy listening to?
You know, so crazy. I don't listen to music anymore. I just, only music I listen to is classical music. Piano and cello.
Beethoven.
I really don't listen to it
over here.
Yeah, I just don't. I mean, Kendrick is cool and stuff like that. I'm just not into the music because it's, you know, it's still selling, so I guess it's still working. But there's so many groups now. It's so, it's not, well, not even really groups, all solo artists and stuff. It's just so many that it's watered down. That's why only a few stands out more than any other one. Because ten people sound the same. Sound like the same producer and stuff. But that's just what this new millennium listened to. That's just their style, so I can't thrash it because that's what they listen to now. It's just their style, you know, what they talking about. You know, it's just a totally different one. It's still hip-hop, but it's just totally different. So, you know, only ones that's going to survive it is the ones that stand out. Only the ones that stand out. Different from everybody. But, I mean, it's still selling. So, and they must be doing something right. It stands. It ain't going nowhere. So, hip-hop is here to stay.
Yeah. And I think when we look at it, because, like you said, Yella, the music, when we look at it now, it seemed like you have to have a certain standard back in the day. Shout out to Uncle Richie Rich from the Bay. We've had him on a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
And Rich would tell us when we interviewed him, like up there, like you weren't getting, they weren't even, the OGs were not letting you in the studio until your shit was right, you know, because you was representing the hood. And it's like now with camera
anybody
phones,
can make it anywhere.
Yeah.
Anybody,
yeah.
You know, everybody got a video. Everybody got a single. Everybody, you know, just that's just the way the market is now. You know, TikTok, YouTube, you can become a star overnight. Back then, if you didn't have no talent, your song ain't going nowhere, or you're not even going to be on a song. Back in them days, but nowadays
right.
It's totally different.
Hey,
a lot of
the
people
let
nowadays. Oh, yeah. Nowadays, a lot of these artists and stuff, they wouldn't have made it back in our day. Nah, you had to be coming. You know, all the groups. Oh, I don't care where it's from, Bay Area, New York, that they was hitting. Texas, I mean, you had to come strong. There wasn't no weak ones back then. Different styles, but there wasn't no weak ones. Nowadays, there's just so many. Too many. There's almost more artists than fans, almost, because everybody's an artist. Everybody got a demo. Ain't even demos no more. They got videos, singles, and mixtapes.
Everybody
and
got
all
a mixtape.
Yeah.
Yeah,
everybody
man.
Got a mixtape. Now, I want to ask you, it's about two albums in particular. I had to leave for a second, but I don't know if you and T-Max built on that. But I want to talk about the solo album that you did, like, back in 96. It had the For the East tribute.
Yeah.
Was there, like, a challenge of you putting that together without Dre and Cube and Easy?
You know what's so crazy? The year before I said I was done with music, you know, so I wouldn't think about it. Then a year later, somebody, you know, the label wanted me to do an album. I'm like, I'm not an artist. You know, I'm not a rapper.
So I'm like, what am I going to do? So I had to get the guy that was on the later Ruthless days, the BG Knockouts and the Dreisters and their sister and other people like that. And it just, I made the album just for a tribute to him, not as trying to make a hit or something.
Got
it. It was just more for him. Just, this is my last thing I'm going to do. I'm going to make this for him. So that's how I made the album. I didn't think of it as, oh, should I get Cube on it? I didn't think about it. None of that at all. None of that. It just was made from the heart. That's what it was. And this is what I came up with, from the heart.
Yeah, and the other album, too, Straight Outta the Streets, mm-hmm. and Motherfucking Compton, was that supposed to be a double album?
Well, Temporary Insanity was original. It was just a title. It never was an album. And it wasn't supposed to be a double album because there weren't that many songs made. All the songs that was left that he done was on that album. And this is the crazy part. I had that album sitting in the studio since he died until a year later when the courts came and asked me about it. I had forgot all about that album. But Mr. Manager, in between that year, tried to get that album from me. He invited me to his house, and he, you know, just talking and talking. And he eventually was saying about the last album. And then when I left that day, I talked to my buddy. I said, did he just try to get the album from me that I forgot all about? I was like, wow, really? And I didn't think nothing else about it. 6 months went past. Then the courts came to me about the album. I said, I got the album sitting in the studio. It was just sitting right there. You guys could have been, came and got it. I wasn't holding it for no ransom and stuff like that. No. Mm-mm. I just told them, hey, I'll put it together. You want me to put it together? I'll put it together. Just find out what you owe me, and that's it. There wasn't no ransom. Oh, I want $1 million. You can have that. No. I wouldn't have done E like that, so why would I do it now? And that was it. That's all. That album sat there for a year, just in the vault at the studio. I never even thought about it because I had gave up music. That was it. I was done. Mm-hmm. If this Scotty brother wouldn't have came asking me to do album, I wouldn't have been doing no music at all. But I did my album, solo album. I did E's solo album, and I did the greatest hit, the N.W.A., all at the same time.
Oh, wow.
All at the same time. Yeah. It's all that's in the book. All of it. I'm telling you, it's a lot of pieces in there. A lot.
Look, the kid's got the capers, because we know that's what you went under your name as a director when you was doing did the movie.
Kid, yeah. You know, the kid came from Purple Rain. That was Prince nickname, the kid.
Right.
Wow. I ain't heard that name in a long.
Yeah, and on top of that, it just shows how sharp you are when it came to curating the greatest hits, because it actually flowed. It had flow structure too. Like those albums had flow structure.
It was like our album. It was like our album with the stuff in between. I found old tapes of our 900 number and stuff that was in the studio.
Oh,
and I just used all that stuff.
I remember the commercials.
That's where,
oh, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because we had a real 900 number back in the early days. Yeah, well, I remember we ended up, you know, doing recordings on them, did them, and they was in the studios. I used them. Just like E's last album. I had to put together and put stuff, some of his old talking from the 900 number 2 that I put on there. And on the last song that Zap Roger did, I had to find some vocals to put on there from him.
Mm. Now, in terms of throwbacks, Ciela, because I don't know if King sent you this, I actually have the original copy of the the Niggas for Life home video cassette. I actually have
I got one too in storage.
Oh, man. And I mean, just looking at it is like, you know.
You know
what's
so funny?
Brings...
I edited that. That was my first editing.
Oh, wow.
Before the
okay.
movie. Yeah, I edited that all together. I didn't do the computer.
So you...
I just told the guy what to use. I went through the tapes,
mm-hmm.
picked out stuff, marked them up, and then told the guy, he put it in the Avid and edited it. But I told him where what to edit and all that stuff. That was my first actual editing. And after that, I started doing movies. Edited them myself.
So you were pretty
but
much
But I didn't
already...
get any credit. I didn't get no credit on that one.
But, I mean, you were already like, I mean, dude, it's like we're getting all this information, a lot
mm-hmm.
of this that I don't know if you've ever told anybody else.
Never.
You know, and
I have not.
Yeah. So we got exclusives here. And it's, I mean, but your
oh, yeah.
talent is, I mean, the talent that you have is like, you know, because when I was growing up, I always like, yo, the light skinned dude in the group always the most quiet one. So we never
yeah.
heard you say much.
I was quiet. I didn't like to talk. Oh yeah.
I'm like, but to get all this history, man. I mean, this is great. I mean,
yeah, because I never talked in interviews this deep. Never. Nobody never asked. Nobody never went that deep. That knew to go that deep. They just didn't know. You know, they use the
mm-hmm.
standard, you know, the standard questions and all that. But that's what the book is all about. It's the same thing. It goes deep like this. Stuff that never was even mentioned. Not at all.
Yeah, because it has a rich history.
And I didn't throw nobody under the bus. It ain't a tell-all because I've seen things. I've heard things, but it's not in the book. I'm not that kind of person. No. Nah.
Plus, it also captivates because, you know, we go through that stage of today's journalism where everybody is, you know, wanting to expose people and, you know, tell off a clip.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's about the music, man. And then, like, and you guys,
yeah.
y'all catapulted and did a transition to where, man, we still eating off that tree today, and we inspired by that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's just wow, it's just amazing. It's just man. I didn't really think until I wrote the book, I didn't know I did that much life. I did a lot of life. It's just like, wow, I did all that. I'm just like, wow. Man.
Oof. When you said that when you sit
especially
back
when
in
you
your
live
golden
through it,
years.
Especially when you live in through it,
yeah.
it's one thing for us to be like,
yeah.
given, you know, an analyst from the outside in. But when you living through it and been through those sessions
yeah.
and met these people, it's a totally different dialogue, man.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, that's why I don't listen to music now. You get in my car, the music is just all the way down because being in the studio for that long and all that over and over, I just like, okay, I'm good. I don't need to be hearing all this.
Yeah. But
yeah,
it's kind of like
Jordan don't want to look at basketball after he done put up all those numbers for 30-something years.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Look, I was watching a joint with Matt Barnes. You know, shout out to the Bay where he's repping, you know, got his Up
mm-hmm.
and Smoke podcast, you know, one of the truest dudes out there to ever, you know, lace him up. And Matt Barnes said when
mm-hmm.
he retired, he hadn't played, because I think Barnes retired like maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and he said he hadn't picked up a basketball since. You know, it was
oh,
like,
yeah.
yeah, it was like just when he was done with the game, he was done with it.
It's like
yeah.
when you get satisfied with it, you're good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't need it no more. Like with the music, I'm done with it. When I finish with the adult, okay, I'm done with it. That's it. I ain't got to do it no more. I ain't got to look at it no more. I'm good. At all. Let me move on.
So as you're in your golden years, Yella, of being a living legend and obviously, you know, a sound mind, body, and spirit, because we see a lot of people, no matter the genre, you know, hip-hop, you know, rock, whatever, you know, celebrities, you know, movie actors and actresses, they crash and burn from their habits. You know, one thing that is so refreshing to see is you're healthy, you're happy, you know, you've lived a full life. What is the average day like for you in terms of just getting up in the morning and just basking and, you know, just, you know.
You know,
just,
I can get up, go to the gym, I can come home and do nothing. Or go outside and sweep the leaves up or something. You know, that's just relaxation. Because now I'm into church now. I've been saved almost 9 years. Now, people
Praise
don't
Lord.
Know this. I was homeless in late 2010 for 3.5 years.
Oh, wow.
Right before the movie came out. Not on the street homeless, but homeless, you know, had to sleep on my sister's couch, stuff like that. Yeah, I was homeless, you know, and I didn't ask anybody for help, or I didn't think of, oh, why don't I just produce something? None of that. None of that. God had to come and get me. He had to clean me out, then he came and got me. Then I got married. After I got saved, and I've been in church ever since. I'm a deacon in the church. And Bible study on Tuesdays, church on Sunday. My mind, you know what's so crazy? I have peace and joy. But people think you can get peace and joy from the money. It's not. You can't buy it. You can't steal it. You can't go borrow it. It only comes from God. And I was sitting right where I'm sitting now, talking to you, and I was looking down the hallway one day, and I said, this is peace and joy. It wasn't about no money, nothing. I don't stress about anything at all. I put it like this. If a bill comes in, either you got the money or you don't got the money. Why be in the middle and stress about it? That's all it is.
Right.
You got it or you don't. Why? Because stressing about it ain't going to fix it. At all, but I never have stressed in my whole life. That's just the way I've been. But I'm at peace now, and joy. And that's who gave me to write the book was God. I never wanted to write a book at all. And he gave me all the detail because the book is 329 pages, 93,800 words. And how can I remember all them words, all them details from the years? If y'all read the book, you'll be amazed. It goes into such deepness. You know, what's been going on all before the music, after the homeless, all that is in the book. All of that.
We need to, because I'm an avid reader. I'll have to.
Oh, really?
You know.
You need to read it.
Yeah, I do. I do.
And people say it's
books.
A good read. I don't know what that is because I never read a book. But they say it's a good read. They said, oh, it's just like you sitting there talking to us. Because God gave me the words to write, and it just flows. It just, you'll be amazed how it ends up and stuff like that. I mean, from 4 or 5 years old, it's pretty amazing.
The Lord gives you that vision in terms of your life because he knows you have a message to deliver to the masses. He opens up that door of memory that you can walk down the halls of recollection, and from that you are able to bring articulation. That anointing cannot be duplicated. It cannot be manufactured. It is a genuine blessing that comes to you. And I always tell everybody, do not ever underestimate the power of the written word. Do not ever dismiss the grace of God that gives you that blessing, that anointing, that gift to tell it to the world.
Because I didn't make the book for money. I made it for the testimony about God, how good he was. He came and got a sinner like me. I'm thinking I'm the worst sinner. And he came and got me. He still loved me and saved me. It's my testimony to show how good he is. And that's exactly what the book says.
if you giving
I threw
advice
you guys for a loop on that one, huh?
we did our homework. You know, we flubbed a little bit of information. Well, myself, I flubbed a little bit of information through this interview in a couple parts. But we always made a point to do our homework the best we knew how. You know, King and myself.
Yeah.
You know, we always make it a point to. What advice would you tell artists in terms of maintaining their sanity in terms of being in this business? Because we've seen people self-destruct in it in terms of they thought they wanted the fame and the fortune, and when they got it. We're not going to ask you about some of the stuff you saw in terms of certain artists during that time in terms of certain things they were involved in. That's not the type of outfit we run here. But what do artists have to understand in terms of, because you guys were doing it at the time. What do artists have to understand about what this business really entails?
I mean, we did our thing, yeah, but, you know, we did in the early days with no contracts, no lawyers, no nothing. And we still maintain our... I'm speaking for me. I was never on drugs or nothing, so...
Right,
gets a lot of them is the drugs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want to be whatever they want to be. Me, I just always was, well, if I make enough money, I'm good, I'm cool. I never wanted to be the superstar. I never wanted to be that kind of stuff. I'm like, I'm good. I got enough. I made enough or whatever the case may be. I'm good. I'm okay. But a lot of people, they can't handle this business. You want to be rich and famous? Okay, this is what comes with being rich and famous. All this stuff comes with it. Did you sell your soul for it? I know I didn't. So it's a lot of people want to be in that entertainment, but like me, I wouldn't want my kids to be in entertainment at all. Nah, it's hard. You got to have some tough skin to be in this business. I don't mean to hold you guys up, but I got another interview at 8:00.
Oh no, you're good. You know. I mean, if you got to go, Yella.
I'm doing one in Australia, so a Zoom.
Dude.
But I mean, I could be here for all day for talking.
Dude, we've enjoyed this.
No, but you guys have real. Questions, not really. I wouldn't even call them questions. Real thoughts and stuff. It ain't just like an everyday interview. No, we got deep here. We went real deep, and that's rare because I usually don't talk too deep, you know, to people. But I enjoyed this. This was relaxed. You see, the time went by. 2 hours flew by.
Yeah.
Man, yeah, 10:50. We almost seven minutes in. I was like, wow, the build is that crazy.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, you guys should both read the book. And we can do a part 2.
We're gonna get it.
Yeah.
We're gonna promote the hell out of it.
Yeah, we'll do a part 2. Because then you have even more questions, more all kind of stuff. It showed my whole life. Towards the end, when God came and got me, it's just because I was not looking for him. I never knew nothing about God. I heard of him. My mother mentioned it, but I never knew nothing. I wasn't, even when I was homeless, I was not looking for him. I didn't know you could look for him or talk to him or ask him. I didn't know none of that. I had never been in the church. None of that. Nobody ever ministered to me. Nothing. But it's all in the book how it happened. You'll be amazed. You will be amazed.
That's my next pickup. We're gonna promote it all over once we get our hands on it.
Man, because see, my friend of mine got the book actually, and he let me borrow it, and he got it back. So I'm probably like 100 already in. So I got to read the rest from him. I'm like, man, I'm about to get my own. I ain't waiting on you, cuz. Straight up.
Do you have it in the retail outlet?
I'm going to bring it back, man. I'm going to bring it back. I'm like, man, I'm just going to get my own.
It's at Amazon. You know, You can get Amazon the paperback or the ebook. Ebook is cheaper. Or autograph ones come from my website.
Oh, perfect.
DJYellowOvenWA.com.
Okay.
But, yeah, I want you guys to read it then. Let's do a part two.
Definitely.
We're here for it. We're here for it.
Definitely. And we enjoyed the bill, man.
And
okay. I mean,
we got to say, and we say this respectfully, because we got to use your government for this. Mr. Caribbe, this has been an honor. This has been a privilege. We can't wait to do this again with you. God bless you and your family. Stay blessed. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much from both of us.
Yeah, and God bless both of you guys. And call me when you're ready.
Yes, sir.
It is, man.
Yeah, just send me an email. Say, hey, we finished. I'm like, okay, let's find a date. Let's set it up.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm gonna give. I'm gonna get my book, man. Like, I'm like, look, man,
yeah.
I'm gonna need to read the second half. You holding off on me? Now he ain't picking up his phone.
Yeah. Okay, I got to do this Zoom for Australia. So.
Okay, man.
Yeah. Let me know when you guys do that, when you guys read it. Let me know.
Yes, sir.
All right, that's a bet.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right.
Thank you. Peace. One.